Hello and welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we give some due to yesterday's more than 100-year-old national holiday honoring American workers. We want to talk about what divides and what unites the organized labor movement in 2009. After all, organized labor was behind the original Labor Day. Just 4 years ago, the schisms, however, were well documented when the Service Employees International Union and others split from the powerful mothership of the AFL-CIO. Many believe that the apparent dilution would damage the best prospects in more than a decade to put a friendly Democrat in the White House, and enough of them in Congress to control the agenda there. Neither proved true, exactly. But is that because labor pulled together when it counted, or because the nation no longer looks to labor to pull the political strings? Despite the apparent turmoil, union membership has stabilized in recent years, and in January, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported a spike in union membership, an increase of 428,000 workers for a total of 16.1 million labor union members in the United States. That might have changed in recent months. I don't know about the economy. But to help clarify that today, I'm pleased to welcome Joe Rigola, president of Ohio AFL-CIO. It's a federation of 56 national and international labor unions. Joe also is executive director of the Ohio Association of Public School Employees. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
My other guest is Becky Williams. She is president of the Service Employees International Union, District 1199. That represents Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia. Becky, welcome.
Good morning.
If you'd like to join the show with your calls or emails, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Well, I guess we should just get started with the schisms. The major issue to the rest of us seem to be leadership issues. Could you talk about that a little bit? Well, what happened 4 years ago, Joe and Becky, and fill us all in?
There's no question that there was some difficult times with SEIU and the AFL and other unions. But ultimately, I think the positive thing is now that what we call the Change to Win unions, which is SEIU and six other unions, have worked quite well with the AFL nationally. And we are looking at a partnership moving forward. But here locally in the state of Ohio, there's no question that SEIU and the AFL have had a remarkable partnership, which was evident in the 2008 elections and continues to grow. There is no divide here in this state. We are working as partners hand in hand.
Were you worried back in, was it 2005?
2005, correct.
When at your national convention, when that happened, did you talk at the time? Were you commiserating together about what it looked like or what, Joe?
Well, I think we were all very concerned about the split in organized labor nationally. And the question, of course, on our minds was what kind of impact would it have on our ability to work together on the ground? Becky's absolutely right, though. We didn't miss a beat. In 2006 in Ohio, there were dozens, hundreds of Ohio AFL-CIO members at SEIU headquarters, where they ran the tremendous phone operation that helped to elect a Democratic slate, including Governor Strickland here in Ohio. So, we were concerned very much about the problems that existed between national leadership and the disagreements over policy direction of the national AFL-CIO and Change to Win. But we really kept we stayed together here on the ground in Ohio, and that was true around the rest of the country as well.
When you're at a big convention like that, are you talking to each other? Are you staying in touch?
We're always talking to each other. I mean, if you're committed to be a labor leader, a leader of working people, you have to be committed to have partnerships and conversation with other labor leaders because, you know, we teach every day that you have power in numbers. And the division and the divide of creating Change to Win versus the AFL wasn't to make us weaker. It was to try to figure out a way to create a different organization to make us stronger. But ultimately, you know, myself, and I'm certain I speak for Joe, we're 100% 100% committed to moving worker issues forward. And you really don't want to do that on your own. You're better off to do it as partners. And so, you know, my theory on this is always build partnerships and collaborate with the labor leaders in your state and across the country. It's to your interest and the workers' interest.
And in addition to that, we're the voice of the middle class in this country. There's no other coherent, unified single voice that speaks on behalf of the American middle class on all kinds of concerns. And as a result of that, we find common ground all the time. And it's certainly true that our work together here in Ohio, I think, has made a huge difference for working families across the state. It made that difference in 2006. And I think our staffs were living together during the 2009 budget deliberations for the state of Ohio as we went through countless long days and nights of work to try to craft a state budget in the face of this economic crisis our country is facing. So I don't really think we missed much of a beat since 2005, and I'm proud of that because we set aside any of those kinds of potentially divisive concerns to work together in the interests of Ohio working families.
Is that what you're hearing around the country? Is that sort of been what it's been like at the state level? Or not necessarily everywhere.
With respect to the budget or the partnership? You know, there's no question that state by state there's somewhat of a different relationship. But everyone that I have connection with in SEIU and, you know, and other unions, they're committed to figure out how to make it a better place for working people. And so they're committed to work with other labor groups in their state and in their district. It's a rare occasion for me to run across to someone that's just committed to do it on their own.
What's the benefits of the split?
I can't think of, in my own judgment, as a traditionalist, I guess. It's hard for me to identify any particular benefit. But I would say this. I've known Becky's National Union President Andy Stern for a long time. And, of course, Andy was the linchpin, in my judgment and the judgment of others, in terms of forming Change to Win and splitting off from the AFL-CIO. And I would say that the split did force all of organized labor to think about our role in a modern and changing global economy and here in America as well. And in that regard, I'm not sure that it didn't do a service to all working families and to the vitality of our movement, because there's no question it injected a new element of discussion and debate about how we shape our future and how we're going to make ourselves over again into the voice of the great middle class in this country.
Okay, absolutely. You're listening to Joe Rigola. He is the president of the Ohio AFL-CIO, and Becky Williams. She is president of the – I'm going to get this straight. She is president of the Service Employees International Union, District 1199. It represents Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia. Let's talk about unifying issues now. The Employee Free Choice Act, which if enacted by Congress, would make it easier for unions to organize workers. How does that work, Becky? How much easier can it get?
Oh, wow. Well, right now it's extremely difficult. If you're a worker in this country and you want a union, and these are real numbers, the minute you speak about the union, 25% of people will be fired by their employer. The minute you speak about the union, about 90% of workers will be pulled into what we call captive audience meetings, where they will be forced to listen to anti-union propaganda and be threatened that their job could be lost.
I thought that was already illegal.
It is absolutely not illegal for the employer to hold captive audience meetings.
Okay.
It is absolutely illegal to fire people because they support the union. It's also illegal for employers to threaten to take your job or to close shop. But the truth is, because we don't have good labor laws in this country, employers really don't care. They will wait it out. They'll pay the small penalty. They'll take the little bit of a slap on the wrist, and they break the law every day. 20 years ago, when I tried to form a union, I was fired, and it took an extremely long amount of time for the National Labor Relations Board to act on it. And if it wasn't for the strength of SEIU, I wouldn't be back on the job. And so Without question, in this country, it's nearly impossible for workers to join the union, and the Employee Free Choice Act would allow an expansion of your right to do that. It would create, in its current format, now, you know, who knows what will come out of Congress, but in its current format, it would allow workers the right to join the union by majority sign up. It would allow a neutral environment for people to do that in, and it would allow for binding arbitration so that you could get your first contract without, you know, without the struggle you do now. So there's no question that it's the first step. It is not the complete Band-Aid. It's not going to fix all of our problems, but it's the first step.
But it sounds like, to me, just another law that employers could violate.
Well, the difference here is that in our society today, in the American workforce today, worker earnings are in a state of steady decline. Real earnings have been going down for a very long time. They go down commensurate with the decrease over the last 30 or 40 years in union membership. There is a direct correlation between the economic welfare of the middle class and working families and the level of union membership in our economy. And I think President Obama recognizes this better than any president since Franklin Roosevelt, that you can't have a healthy economy and a strong middle class without a vital and vibrant trade union movement. Now, we wouldn't mind if there was a true free market in the question of organizing and the labor environment. But there is no free market. The laws are stacked against trade unions and their ability to organize, and there's no question, Becky is completely right. Historically, the enforcement of existing laws has been very lax, and employers get away with murder on the work site in terms of firing people the instant that they begin to talk about trade unions. So since reputable independent polls show that nearly two-thirds of American workers would join a union if they weren't terrified of the possibility of losing their jobs, we need EFCA to give those people an opportunity to have a voice in the workplace.
Okay, so how would that enforcement work?
I wanted to follow up on your question about, you know, bad employers. They're just, it's another law. They're just going to break it. Well, the truth is there are going to be some employers that will figure out a way to break every law on the books. But the one benefit of the Employee Free Choice Act as written, currently being discussed, is it allows for greater penalties for employers that choose to do that, up to $2,000 and more in fines every time they violate, in addition to what other penalty would be established based on the offense. You know, but there's no question that Joe is right. 60% plus of workers say, if I had the right without fear and intimidation to join the union, hands down, I would do it. And so I think if we can get that door open and allow workers a greater chance of getting into the union, the employers that would violate the law, I think there are stricter provisions in this bill that would protect workers' right and penalize workers that do that.
There is one. There's one other specific example of why this matters as well. It does depend on who's calling the shots and who's in the White House. The enforcement of labor laws has been so lax for a generation.
Absolutely.
In this country. A great example is a series of coal mining tragedies that took place during the Bush administration when Bush wiped out the Mine Health and Safety Act enforcement provisions. So it isn't just that we want to rewrite the laws. We want to make sure that they're enforced. And right now, President Obama's back on track to really enforce labor laws across the board in this country.
Okay, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about labor issues with two of Ohio's top labor leaders. Join the conversation by giving us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll return in just a minute.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard.
The owners of the mall say the building will be systematically dismantled.
You know, lamentably, there's a large amount of square footage of building there that, frankly, is only 20 years old. But I think what you have to do is look forward and say, what is the opportunity?
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and Classical Music.
And good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, currently 67 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Taking a look at the weather forecast, cloudy skies today with a chance of rain showers, maybe a thunderstorm and a high of 75. Clear skies tonight, but still a slight chance of rain and a low of 58 degrees. Some sunshine on Wednesday and a chance of rain showers and thunderstorms, a high of 78. And Wednesday night, a chance of evening rain and a low of 59. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher and a little bit of Pete Seeger talking union. And we're talking labor issues with two of Ohio's top labor leaders, Becky Williams of the Service Employees International Union and also Joe Rigola of the Ohio AFL-CIO. Joe, earlier when we were talking about why there's more support for this kind of a law, the Free Choice Act, the proposed law, you mentioned some tragedies in the United Mine Workers movement. What happened?
Well, we went through a series early in this decade of tragic mine accidents that really resulted directly from the fact that the Bush administration had halved the number and amount of resources devoted to mine safety inspections and mine safety law enforcements. And the Bush administration had placed a coal company executive in charge of the federal agency that administers the Mine Health and Safety Act. It was the quintessential fox guarding the hen house. And the result was that a steady deterioration and decline in the enforcement of those critical laws that protect our people who mine underground and generate coal for energy in this country. The Obama administration has really dramatically changed that, as well as the enforcement of many other labor laws in the country. And we're looking forward to a more fair and balanced approach in the years ahead. And the hope is that the Employee Free Choice Act will be part of that broader reform movement that will give workers more of a voice about their lives and livelihoods and their place in the great American economy.
You know, Becky, the SEIU is the fastest growing union in the world.
Correct.
So why do you feel that there isn't enough freedom to join a union?
Because there just isn't. There's no question that workers that we deal with every day, and make a claim that they want to have the union, quickly experience what I just described, where they're fired, they're threatened, they're intimidated, and they don't make it to the election day even. So there's no question the evidence exists both in what you'll read, but what we see every day when we talk to workers. And no matter how big SEIU gets, there is no question there is 60% of this nation that would like to have a union that can't. And one point I'd like to make is that not only does it grow union membership, but it's been proven that workers that have a union are 28% more likely to have employer-based health care and 54% more likely to have a pension plan if they have a union. So by bringing more people into the union, in fact, we are definitely making changes in this economic crisis that we're experiencing for the average working person.
And Becky, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are 60,000 illegal worker dismissal cases pending in front of the National Labor Relations Board.
They
right
were going
now.
To catch up with that.
Well, they will if they get serious about enforcement. And I think that's Becky's point about EFCA and other labor laws. If we're serious about enforcement, we'll catch up. And the bottom line is if we get to the place where workers aren't fired anymore simply for saying the word union, then I think we're looking at a much improved economic outlook for our country.
It sounds like the DNA backlog in the coroner's offices around the world. NPR, National Public Radio's Peter Overby said that if you give the bill the free
Employee Free Choice Act.
Employee Free Choice Act. It's right there. That if you give the Employee Free Choice Act a political read, it would appear to be asking Congress to decide if unions do more good or harm in a sinking economy. And I guess, in essence, it's asking the nation to decide that as well. How do you – what kind of political read do you put on it?
Well, I there's no question that if we want a vibrant middle class, a strong middle class, we're going to have a strong trade union movement. President Obama said that yesterday in his remarks to the Cincinnati labor movement when he spoke at the AFL-CIO Labor Day event there. So we're not going to accept the argument that we need to drive down wages, benefits, pensions, and other worker rights in order to compete in a global economy. What we need to do is raise people up.
Absolutely.
That's the history of the American labor movement and the trade union movement around the world. So we're going to argue until we're blue in the face, till our last breath, that if we want a strong economy, a strong middle class where people get some decent fair share of the wealth that they generate, then we need a strong trade union movement.
Absolutely. And the one thing I would mention is that the Employee Free Choice Act, what it is doing is it's taking a 70-year-old bill that currently gives the employer the right to have majority sign up, and it's saying that now the workers have the right. Because for 70 years, employers across this country have been able to say, I can accept the union through an election or majority sign up. They've had that right. All this bill does now is give workers that same right. And, you know, to me, it's caused a lot of controversy just because employers don't want it. But there's no question that it will raise up the standards. It will help to change this economic crisis that we're in for working families. And it will allow workers a greater voice on the workplace, in the workplace.
Let's listen to that remark by President Obama yesterday in Cincinnati when he addressed, I don't know, I think it was 20,000 labor union members and others.
Much of what we take for granted, the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage, health insurance, paid leave, pensions, Social Security, Medicare, they all bear the union label.
Do you think he's right?
Absolutely.
That Americans take for granted that positive impact?
No question about it. Millions of American workers may not carry a union card, but they're members of the trade union movement. Our movement is responsible for the 40-hour work week, for the minimum wage, for health and safety laws, for the Family Medical and Leave Act, for women's rights, for civil rights, and so many other advances in our society. And the bottom line is that everybody benefits from that, whether they realize it or not.
So if people don't realize where that's all coming from, do you think you're doing a really bad PR job selling unions, not just in terms of increasing your membership, but educating the public on what unions did?
I would quickly just say that there's no question that we could figure out a better way to get the union message out there. But 60% of people when polled now say they joined the union. 60%, that's pretty significant. 500,000 people in this country in 2008 said yes to a union. One of the largest increases in union numbers in decades. Mm-hmm. And so there's no question that American people understand the importance of a union. They may not attribute every success or everything in their paycheck to the union movement, but there's no question that if given an opportunity, the average working person would select a union. So those aren't bad numbers.
Some people think that the union involvement in the industrial revolution and in over the past 40 or 50 years has been also part of the problem. That it's the intransigence of the management side of the equation is equal only to the same thing from the union side. a lot of people criticize that. You know, the unions won't move on something. Once they get their contract signed, that's it, no matter what happens to the economy. The most recent example of that kind of criticism is occurring right now with teachers and other school workers who are having to decide between themselves whether or not to go back on some of their contracts. People in Worthington, for instance, are asking teachers to reconsider their latest contract and not take the pay increase that they had negotiated and spent a couple years negotiating, as a matter of fact.
There are workers all over the country today represented by unions who are reshaping their collective bargaining agreements to account for the problems in their industry. No better example of that than the moves that the auto workers have made, not just in recent months when the auto industry problems have attracted so much attention, but over the last two decades. The American auto worker has reshaped their work life in order to accommodate the needs of the auto industry in a competitive global economy. I am convinced that the problems that the auto industry's experience have been the result of management decisions and business decisions that have been made over the last couple of decades. And I disagree completely that workers in the public sector are intransigent as well. You may be able to find anecdotal examples around Ohio where that's been the case, but that is not the case in the majority of instances. I know Becky will affirm this. Our people have been making adjustments to their contracts for far longer than the economic crisis that we're in right now in order to help employers stay competitive and to more reasonably attach worker productivity to gains in worker earnings. So I don't buy the argument at all that unions are intransigent, and as a movement, I know that we're constantly looking for ways to shape cooperative efforts with management in order to advance the interests of the whole economy overall.
Absolutely, and I can tell you, here in the state of Ohio, all state unions acted responsibly. In 20 years of being in the labor movement, saw an amazing group of state employees, from SEIU members to OCSEA members, across the board. 60,000 state workers were asked to take huge sacrifices in their collective bargaining agreements or just in their policies and procedures. And no one wanted to do it, there's no question, but every single person did it. And we did it without a fight. We did it without any concerted activity. And, you know, we all made equal sacrifices. So I just find it absurd that anyone would really believe in this state that union workers aren't open and honest and real to the economic crisis, because it simply just is not so.
Now, back to the threshold question that you asked about how our message resonates in American society. I think SEIU certainly, and I know my own great national union, AFSCME, which is about 1.5 million members, along with the national FL-CIO, recognize that we have to find a better and more effective way to talk to working families in the middle class in this country. Coming out of the national FL-CIO Pittsburgh convention next week, I know we'll have new leadership. It'll be Rich Trumka, the president or former president of the mine workers and now secretary-treasurer of the national FL-CIO. And I know that Rich and Andy Stern and Jerry McEntee and so many other labor leaders understand that we have to find a better way to deliver the message about the core of trade union values to the entire American workforce.
Okay, that's Joe Rigola. He is the president of the Ohio AFL-CIO, and also joining us today is Becky Williams of the SEIU District 1199. We're going to take some calls in a few minutes. In the meantime, if you have a call or a story about the union movement, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I still wonder about that political read, that what is Congress going to do with that, with the legislation pending in there? How hard are you working? I understand that there's offices on the ground in 35 states now. I don't know if that's the SEIU. But what are you doing in the states to promote that legislation, or is this image work that has to be done part of all of that?
Well, I think a couple of points there. That what is moving in Congress right now, and obviously occupying the the great American debate is the question of health care reform. And we understand that the Employee Free Choice Act and other components of labor law reform are not going to be addressed in the immediate future until we get certain other things like health care reform off the table. In that regard, we're focused on that issue right now because health insurance companies have done great. Their profits are up dramatically. Health insurance company executives are doing just fine. It's American workers who are suffering as a result of the problems and the crisis in health care right now. So we understand that we need to focus on that health care reform component and make sure that that moves because that benefits every American worker, whether they're a trade union member or not.
Okay, we've got a call from Harold. He wants to ask about working class education and apprenticeships, maybe something else that the trade union movement can offer people. Harold, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I'm wondering if you would comment on the National Labor Education Center and the National Labor College and the programs down there for worker education. And I'm wondering if you would also talk a little bit about the future of apprenticeship programs in particularly unorganized areas, but new apprenticeship programs. I know the existing programs have been very strong. And I do agree with much of what you said. I think labor has experienced attempted manslaughter, death by a thousand cuts, and everything from the power at the bargaining table since the 1960s has forced concessions and forced givebacks for workers. I was a workplace representative. I saw this for most of my career.
Let me comment on the last point first. We're never going to accept the argument that global competition should force American workers and the middle class into accepting a decline in their standard of living. That the trade union movement in this country will fight that to our last breath. On the question of apprenticeship programs, very important question because it's a good example of how hard our building, particularly our construction and building trades unions, work inside their communities to give young people an opportunity to move into the workforce in productive, good-paying jobs that will enable them to support a family. Great friends of mine, and tonight I'm traveling to the Scioto County to speak to the Central Labor Council there. And their leadership is really working hard along with so many other local folks on developing apprenticeship programs that give young people an opportunity to move into good jobs that will secure for them a piece of the American pie, so to speak. The National Labor College and other programs like that are terrific programs. They're supported by national unions, and they give really average workers an opportunity to become involved more in the national movement and to obtain the skills that are necessary to enable them to advance the cause of working families wherever they live, in the communities and states where they live. So those are all terrific programs and a great example of how the trade union movement impacts working families in general and not just the card-carrying members of our unions.
Okay, we have an email from a listener. He says that in addition to helping working families, unions help elect Democrats. So I guess they're going to inject a little raw politics into the discussion. Ohio Democrats face two likely primaries next year. The email goes on. One for the open Senate seat between Jennifer Bruner and Lee Fisher. One for the open Secretary of State seat between Jennifer Garrison and Marilyn Brown. Should Labor or the Ohio Democratic Party endorse in those races? What do you say, Becky?
SEIU's position at this point is that we are not we have not endorsed in the U.S. Senate race. And, you know, just quite honestly, I want to back up just a little bit. The question really in my mind when I hear that is labor elects Democrats. And I am proud to say as a leader of SEIU that we take a very firm position that we look at all sides. We look at voting records. And I, as the leader of SEIU, am not just looking to move Democrats forward. In fact, I've had members with the president of the Senate here. A great Republican leader. I and our members have also spent time with other Republican leaders. And what we are looking for
are progressive leaders that really are committed to change laws and policies for working people. If it happens to be a Democrat, absolutely, they'll get SEIU support. If it happens to be a Republican, again, they will get SEIU support.
Let's come back to Joe Rigola on that question right after this. Welcome. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking labor issues with two of Ohio's top labor leaders. Join the conversation by giving us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll return in just a minute.
In my job, you make decisions about education, art and design, and about the stewardship of young people's lives every day. Without a daily dose of NPR, I don't think I'd be as effective as I could otherwise be. It's the place I go to kind of get my mind open and my sensibilities attuned to what's going on. I'm Danny Griffith, president of CCAD, and WOSU is my source for cultural content.
And good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 68 degrees in downtown Columbus. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides. In light of the recent news story about a Central Ohio Muslim teenager who ran away to Florida to escape parental authority, we'll take a deeper look at adolescent development, family dynamics, and religion. That's on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies and a good chance of rain showers, maybe a thunderstorm this afternoon, and a high of 75. Tonight, a chance of rain shower, still a chance of a thunderstorm tonight, and a low of 58 degrees. For Wednesday, sunshine and a chance of rain showers on Wednesday as well, a high of 78. Looking ahead to Thursday, a 30% chance of afternoon rain, otherwise cloudy, and a high of 79. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
My daddy was a miner, and I am a miner's son. And I'll stick with the union till every battle's won. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That's Which Side Are You On by Joe Glazier. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me in the studio today are Becky Williams, president of the SEIU District 1199, which represents more than 35,000 healthcare workers, service workers. You started out in the healthcare industry yourself in a
Absolutely.
Nursing home, I believe.
No.
Pardon me?
No.
It wasn't a nursing home.
No, it was a training center for the mentally retarded.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. And Joe Rigola, president of the Ohio AFL-CIO. Joe, we were talking about politics before the break. Why don't you get back and tell us where your group stands?
Well, this son and grandson of a coal miner believes that the future of our movement and the future of the working class, middle class in this country is tied indirectly to how we do politics in America, how we do politics here. In Ohio, I was privileged before I took over the AFL-CIO presidency 2.5 years ago to chair the political program at the Ohio AFL-CIO for 5 years, beginning in late 2002. So we have shaped a political program that's designed to move public policy and public agenda for the middle class and working families, and we certainly don't make any apology about that. So your question of raw politics, we'll take politics whether it's raw or not. We don't care. As long as Becky said, we have public officials and don't care what party they're from, frankly, who have some concern over the welfare of working families in this country. Now, let's don't make any mistake about it. Politics is at the core of what we do. We went through a generation in this country where the financial industry, banks, and Wall Street were deregulated in the name of producing profits for the already super rich. And beginning last September, we saw what happens when you move public policy in that direction. Our economy crumbled, banks in crisis, Wall Street in crisis, and on the verge of really a very, very real chance of another significant depression in this country. Those things happen because we failed to do politics and because we made political choices in this country that moved policy in that direction. So we don't care what color they are or what party label they wear. We want people that will advance responsible political and public policy positions on behalf of the middle class.
Let's turn to an issue that is kind of raging across the country right now. Tomorrow night, the President Obama will address the Congress and the nation on the issue of health care coverage. Let's talk to Lawrence. He is called to ask about health care reform and nursing homes. Lawrence?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hear a lot about the health care reform that's being discussed. I think it's a good idea. I think we should go forward with it. But I'm not hearing very much about nursing homes and care for elderly people. I want to make a quick comment and then ask a question. We recently put my mother into a nursing home, and I have to say in the months that she's been in there, I've been really disappointed with the quality of care she's got. And it's not because of the people that work in the home. I think they're just shorthanded. There are not enough of them. And I try to raise this with a nursing home, and they don't listen to me. So my question would be this. Is there some way that we can get at these nursing homes and get at their money? Like, I'd like to find some way to get at the money that comes at them through the government so that nursing homes get better for the people who work in them, but especially for people like my mom and other elderly people who have to be in there. So maybe that's a political question or a labor question, but I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you, Lawrence. Becky?
Yeah, here in the state of Ohio, it really is alarming when you look at our long-term care system. We have about $4.5 billion, Medicaid dollars, designated to provide care in the long-term care industry. And of that, $2.5 billion is taken into long-term care nursing homes. And so there's not a lot of money left over to really provide any other care. And so right now, currently, if his grandmother or mother would like to go and have care at home where she could receive it from her neighbor, her friend, or a member of her family, there's now a waiting list to get through that passport program because there's just no funding for it. And so I would encourage the caller to call members of, our legislative body and ask them to really pay attention to what we call rebalancing Ohio's long-term care system, where we start to put the Medicaid dollars into allowing Ohioans the choice. And then we will open up more options for home and community-based care. Because right now, the default position in the state is if, Ann, you were injured tomorrow and really needed care and didn't have the financial means to get it on your own, you are entitled to nursing home care and would be put in a nursing home if you needed long-term care. You would not be entitled to home care. And if there wasn't a slot available, you, even though you wouldn't probably want to live in a nursing home, may be forced to. I know many people that have been forced to do that. And so we really need to get our, from our governor to our members of the legislative body to say that in our next biennial budget that we pay close attention to where we put the money, and we really need to divert some of it to home and community-based services.
You're listening to WOSU All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to call or leave an email, that's 614-292-8513 or allsides@wosu.org. Let's see. We've got Dan. Nope. I guess our caller dropped off. Okay. No, Bill. Bill, you wanted to know about where unions stand on health care. Are you still there?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
And where do you stand on health care? Oh, excuse me.
Army.
I call because there is somewhat of a earlier in the conversation mentioning that unions support, encourage, work for the members to have fringe benefits, including health care, which are employer-based health care systems. What does the union stand on going to universal health care that would essentially make it a government-based system?
Well, let me say this, first of all, to not just this caller's, but the last caller's question about nursing home care. I sympathize with that caller's concern. My sisters and I made that very same choice not so long ago. It's very difficult for families to make. And Becky and her union have really led the way in Ohio on this question, and I commend SEIU for what they've done. But in terms of how we stand on health care generally, what we want isn't complicated. We want the emphasis to be on health care for American citizens and their families, not on profits for insurance companies. Insurance companies have been doing wonderfully in this country. So we think that it's time for health care reform that emphasizes actual health care. Now, most of our members have health care under the collective bargaining agreements and the arrangements that we have with our employers. So when we advocate for good health care coverage for every American citizen, we're advocating for people who aren't members, generally speaking, of the trade union movement. Now, let's take a look at the public option and the question of whether government ought to be engaged. If we could have a system like Medicare for all citizens that delivers quality health care, but does so at very low costs and without generating high overhead costs, which is true of American insurance, private insurers, I think that our country would be better off. Now, our health care proposal, the president's, does not advocate going to a universal single-payer government program. What it does advocate is supplementing private insurance with a public option that will both offer other alternatives to people who have no place else to go and help to hold down private insurance health care costs. So that's our position, and that's what we're fighting for in the Congress.
And I know you're in agreement on that topic. What are you hoping to hear from the president tomorrow night when he addresses Congress? Becky?
My hope is that both from the president and the members of Congress that we get an absolute commitment that all Americans are going to have access to affordable, quality health care. It is alarming for me as an individual leader in this state, but as a just a member of my family and watching other members of a family suffer. Right now, we have 47 million people without health care, and that's just a number to a lot of people. It doesn't really resonate. But every week that we go without a reform, without a fix to this health care system, we're going to have 44,000 more people enter those numbers. And out of that, the estimates are that 400 people every week will die as a result of not having that medical care. That is alarming. And until our members of Congress and our president say we are absolutely fully committed to make certain that we are going to allow every American affordable, quality health care, the SEIU will not stop.
Well, that seems to be generally what the president has said.
Absolutely.
Since long before he was even a candidate for the presidency. What sort of code words are you looking for tomorrow night? I guess we're kind of at that 11th hour. It's the do or die time before the holidays. They want to get something done. What are you looking for, Joe, tomorrow night?
I'm looking for the president to say that we need to do exactly as Becky said, develop a health care system that makes affordable coverage available to every American citizen. Somewhere in this country today, a devoted and loving couple that have been married all their lives are going to decide to divorce because health care costs are driving them apart. That is absolutely unthinkable in a civilized and very wealthy country like our own. Somewhere today as well, some pregnant mother is going to make a decision about health care that she can't afford and about care for her unborn child that's going to affect that baby's health for the rest of that child's life. These things are unthinkable in a country that is as wealthy as ours. And the bottom line is we're looking for the president to advance the idea that Becky laid forth, that we have got to have health care coverage available to every citizen that every citizen can somehow afford to obtain.
The one other thing I would really want to hear him say is party politics will not stop this. That absolutely right now what's going on is just alarming. That we've got politics at its best stopping people from getting health care. And I would like him to say that he is fully committed to moving forward regardless of the politics. And, you know, if you have to do it with just the Democrats, so be it. But don't let more Americans suffer because we can't stop playing politics.
Or politics at its worst,
at
stopping
its worst.
People from getting their health care, I suppose. Let's turn our sights to the environment briefly. We have a few more minutes, and we'll take some more calls, too. If you want to call us, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joe, talk about the environment and where that the environmental issues have created something of a split.
Well, I don't think the question is so much whether there's a split inside the labor movement over environmental issues, because while there are nuanced differences of a policy approach from union to union, the bottom line is that as a movement overall, we recognize first that green jobs and the environment as a broad issue are going to have an effect on the future of working families in this country. And there are so many great initiatives going on out there. The Apollo Project, the Blue-Green Alliance between the steelworkers and the environmental movement, all of which are designed to help this country create environmentally sensitive jobs, green jobs, that will help us provide energy without polluting any further and hopefully reversing the effects of pollution. So, you know, we recognize that green jobs are a critically important part of our future, but they also really only have meaning if they're part of overall economic policies, tax policies, and trade policies that recognize that we have to develop these kinds of jobs but remain competitive in a global marketplace and at the same time protect American industries from the impact of cheap labor and cheap energy being provided from overseas.
One of the you mentioned the United Mine Workers earlier. That is one industry that is directly affected by the proposals in the American Clean Energy and Security Act. They call it a job killer. It's too many restrictions. How do you talk with your members about that issue when you're representing so many different kinds of workers?
Well, what I say, I'm consistent in what I've said about green jobs and about the role of coal in our future in this country. We have more coal available to us to burn than Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Middle East has oil. I think we're crazy for not burning it. But I also think we have to recognize that if we can put a man on the moon in 8 or 9 years, we ought to be able to figure out a way to burn coal cleanly. Now, that's what the Apollo Project and other projects like it are all about, bringing American technological know-how to bear on these energy questions. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we've got to be aggressive about developing wind energy, solar energy, and other alternatives that are green. The question is how we will do that while continuing to develop and create good-paying jobs and keep ourselves competitive and not at the same time sacrifice the living standards of American workers in order to do so.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're almost out of time. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My thanks go to Becky Williams of the Service Employees International Union, District 1199, and also Joe Rogola of the Ohio AFL-CIO. Thank you so much for being on my first show today.
You.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a privilege.
Thanks.